matter of fact.
Well, we will hopefully bring Floyd of Rosedale back home to Iowa City this fall. One more editorial comment. Come on, guys. Dr. Arthur Herman is the author of 7 books, including the New York Times bestselling How the Scots Invented the Modern World, the Pulitzer Prize finalist Gandhi and Churchill, To Rule the Waves, How the British Navy Shaped the Modern World, and the highly acclaimed Freedom's Forge, How American Business Produced Victory in World War II, which The Economist magazine picked as one of the best books of 2012. Educated at the University of Minnesota and Johns Hopkins University in history and classics, Dr. Herman is a frequent contributor on defense, energy, technology issues to Commentary Magazine, The New York Post, The National Review, and The Wall Street Journal. He was also the first non-British citizen to be named to the Scottish Arts Council from 2007 to 2009. Please join me in giving a warm First in the Nation welcome to Dr. Arthur Herman.
Thank you very much. It's my enormous pleasure to be here, in front of you, and to be talking to Governor Jindal about issues which are of enormous importance to all of us. I think maybe 2 years ago, people would have thought, how could debates and discussions about foreign policy be key to the presidential election in 2016? Well, guess what? They are, and they're becoming more important. And it's our pleasure to be able to talk to Governor Jindal and to hear his views on these crucial subjects, not just for our own country, but really for global stability and peace in just about every continent in the country now, in the world now. Let me ask you this. 6 years ago, an administration came into office that decided it knew the formula for fixing the world's problems and the United States' position in it. And that formula was retreat. That if we withdrew American power and American influence around the world, starting in the Middle East, but also in Europe and also in Asia, that this would, in fact, enormously enhance America's position in the world and would be a major contributor to world stability and to peace in regions and in settling down the threats that our allies face, whether it was Israel or Japan and other allies in NATO. That hasn't really worked out so well, has it? My question for you, my first question for you is that since the policy of American retreat, of United States withdrawing its influence, even apologizing for its past deeds, hasn't worked and has actually had the opposite effect, if you were president, what kinds of steps would you take in order to reverse that process and to restore American leadership? What are the principles on which you'd build that?
Great question. I first of all want to thank our host organization for having us. I want to thank the Mudd family as well for opening up this beautiful facility. I want to thank each and every one of you for coming out today as well. It's certainly not my first visit either to this community or to this great state, but I do appreciate your taking the time. It is a wonderful first question. So we have seen that trying to lead from behind doesn't work. You can't pick a part of the world that is safer today because of the Obama administration's foreign policy. You look around the world. So Iran is on the march in the Middle East with more influence in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen. You look over in Europe, you've got Putin on the march in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. You look over in Asia, China is now rising, and you see allies like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and other allies very, very worried about its territorial ambitions at the expense of its neighbors. So clearly, leading from behind hasn't worked. What does work is peace through strength. We need to get back to a foreign policy where our friends trust us, our enemies fear and respect us. Now, what does that mean in practical terms? Well, number one, I'm a strong advocate for shrinking the size of our federal government, balancing our budget. But one of the areas where we actually need to be investing more, not less in, is in America's military, in our defense. The Constitution tells the federal government it has one core responsibility, and that's to protect our country. Under President Obama, this government, this federal government, has grown out of control. It is doing so many things it was never intended to do. As a result, it's not fulfilling its core obligations, its responsibilities. We saw that most recently with this cyber attack that allegedly came from the Chinese government. And we can talk more about these asymmetrical attacks, whether they be biological or cyber or whatever. But first, We need to be investing in our military. I wrote a paper where I've said we need to get back to 4% of our GDP where we invest in our military, not overnight. And yes, we need procurement for them. I'm not saying waste dollars. We need to spend those dollars more efficiently, but we must not hollow out our military. We're going to have fewer troops, fewer planes, fewer ships, older equipment than we've had in decades. We are spending more in our federal government than we've done since World War II, and yet we're spending less in our military as a share of our economy, and that's just wrong. Secondly, we need to go and show the world we will be a reliable partner. So, for example, we need to show Israel we will stand unequivocally with her when she is defending herself against Hamas, Hezbollah. You look at how this president has treated allies and treated enemies. He has done the opposite. So when he talks about Israel, he almost talks like there's a moral equivalence between Israel and the terrorists. Whenever there's a conflagration out there, he'll say, well, both sides need to give up something and come to the table. Well, there's only one side sending their civilians to go and blow themselves up, their children and others, and these suicide bombers, to go and target civilians. There's only one side that's doing that. Israel's not doing that. And so we must stop talking in terms of moral equivalence and say, we stand with Israel. Instead of alienating the prime minister, instead of undermining their government, we need to stand with our allies. But we need to do that around the world. We've been studying the Keystone Pipeline, I don't know how many years. What's left to study? The Canadians want to sell us the oil. It's real simple. The Canadians want to sell us the oil. If we don't buy it, they'll sell it to the Chinese. Why in the world wouldn't we want to help our economy, help their economy? This president keeps looking for shovel-ready projects. This is a $5 billion shovel-ready project. Won't involve any borrowing from the Chinese. Privately funded. It's ready to go. Let's show our allies as well as our enemies we mean business, but it also means our enemies. That means no deal with Iran that allows them to become a nuclear power. I'm amazed this president seems intent to sign a bad deal that could start a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. From a country, by the way, where we're not even willing to say as part of the deal that they have to recognize Israel's right to exist. A country, by the way, where recently the leaders were in a crowd where they were chanting death to America, death to Israel. We're not even demanding they release their American prisoners. And yet this is a regime we think that it's okay, they could be on the verge of becoming a nuclear power. So our friends need to trust us, our enemies need to fear and respect us. And then finally, we need to name the enemies that we face. We've got a president who won't even name radical Islamic terrorism, doesn't even like to say those words. Now, don't worry, he will protect us from medieval Christians. You know, if the Crusades come back, he's on guard. He'll have our back if that happens. I've made a deal. I went to the White House and said, look, if he will protect us from radical Islamic terrorists, I'll keep an eye out for the medieval Christians. I'll make that deal with the president. I'm pretty sure we've got that threat covered. How can we beat ISIS if we don't even recognize the enemy that they are? We need a commander-in-chief that says we are going to hunt down and kill these radical Islamic terrorists that threaten us, that want to change and threaten our way of life, that threaten our allies. We have seen, you're exactly right, we have seen now six, almost 7 years of America trying to lead from behind. It doesn't work. A stronger America, peace through strength, works. I never want America's military in a fair fight. Any potential fight, I want our military to be able to dominate. I want to make sure, and here's the irony, I'll close with this observation. President Reagan deployed troops less frequently than the presidents before and after him. The best way to avoid war is to prepare for it. If our enemies feared us, Putin wouldn't be in the Ukraine. If he truly feared and respected what might happen out of the United States and our allies, weakness only provokes evil. Weakness only provokes radical Islamic terrorists. Peace through strength. It's not just a slogan. It should be the foundation of our foreign policy.
I'm going to talk to you now, ask you about three areas you named, three ones which I think are both vital to American security, but also are very much on the minds of American voters. And one reason why there is such disquiet about what's happening in the world under this administration. The first one is ISIS. And guess what? ISIS isn't just a threat in terms of its atrocities and beheadings and its spreading power and influence in the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq. Talk about, by the way, American retreat. Mm-hmm. That's the most blatant example of a president who walked away from a status of forces agreement, could have left in place the stability, the stable balance of forces that made Iraq such a really fledgling democracy. And now, look at it now, the shambles it's in. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen over the last year isn't just the rise of ISIS as a deadly threat in the Middle East, but we're seeing it as a rising threat here at home, with its recruitment of gullible young people, men and women, saying, come on over. You're going to have a great time over here. Join the winners, which is the establishment of the caliphate and the establishment of an Islamic state. We've seen them use social networks in a sophisticated way, the kind of things that you usually think of Hollywood studios or television networks would do in order to build that network. And the fear that a lot of Americans have that this terror network at home that's being built by ISIS is just at the beginning, and this may in fact be something in which we'll run amok later on. What's going to be your approach to dealing with the ISIS threat at home and abroad?
You're exactly right. We saw the threat in Garland, Texas. This is not just a threat in Iraq or in Paris or in Australia. This is a threat coming here, and that's why we've got to take this threat seriously. And by the way, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, I was very happy that you saw what happened in Texas. They shot and killed those terrorists before they could take innocent life. You know, maybe they shouldn't try that kind of foolishness in Texas or in Iowa or Louisiana. I've joked that for us, gun control means being able to hit your target. So, I mean, maybe that's not the best place you might want to try that kind of foolishness. But in terms of how do you take on ISIS here at home as well as abroad, several things. Number one, the president, I think, should say this today. I think he should say to Muslim leaders that Islam has a problem. That problem is radical Islam. Muslim leaders, clerics, and others should do two things immediately. Number one, they should make it very clear that these members of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, other radical Islamic terrorists, all these other radical individuals, they need to condemn them by name. Not just generic acts of violence. It's not enough to say, oh, the bombing in the marketplace was wrong or the taking of innocent human life was wrong. That's fine, but they need to go further. Condemn these individuals by name and say they are not martyrs. They're not enjoying a reward in the afterlife. But rather, they're going straight to hell where they belong. And the second thing I'd like to see the president call on Muslim leaders to do is to recognize explicitly that they recognize and respect the religious liberty and other rights and freedoms for other people of different religious beliefs than their own. Because we have to beat ISIS militarily, diplomatically, as well as culturally. I gave a speech in London at the beginning of this year where I talked about the threat of radical Islamic terrorism, and I got, some on the left didn't like it. When I said, when it comes to letting people in our country, we should only let people in our country who want to be Americans. To me, that's common sense. You shouldn't let somebody who wants to come into our country to use our own freedoms to undermine those same freedoms for other people. Now, we used to proudly call ourselves a melting pot. We used to be proud of our assimilation. I think one of the things we can do is stop calling ourselves hyphenated Americans. We're not Irish Americans or African Americans or Asian Americans. We're Americans. So one, we've got to take this threat culturally as well as militarily and diplomatically. So secondly, militarily, we have got to defeat ISIS. ISIS is different from Al-Qaeda in that they need to hold on to territory to establish this caliphate. And so if you break their ability to hold property in Syria and Iraq, no, that doesn't mean that you've driven out and killed all the radical Islamic terrorists, but you make it much harder for them to recruit, to raise resources and money and new members. We need to be working more closely with the Kurds. I see where Senator Ernst here, she's got an amendment in the Senate that would allow our government to do that. We should be working more closely with the Kurds. They've shown in Kobani that they can effectively fight and defeat ISIS. They've been protecting Christians and other religious minorities in the region already. In Kobani, you had allied airstrikes as well as Kurds on the ground actually beat ISIS. In addition to helping arm the Kurds, secondly, we need to be giving more assurances to our Sunni allies that we are there to win this fight. I think you had mentioned what happened in Iraq. Well, as well in Syria, we had that failed red line where the president drew this line in the sand, didn't enforce it. We've got Sunni allies that will help us, but they don't want to beat ISIS only to help strengthen Assad and therefore Iran. And so we need to reassure our Sunni allies and other allies in the region that we are committed to actually defeating our enemies, and as well as having a more friendly regime in Syria as well. And third, you go back to what you said about the status of forces agreement. You're exactly right. We need to take the political handcuffs off of our military. And so right now, the president's got an authorization of use of military force in the Congress with two provisions that Congress needs to change. One, there's a 3-year deadline. Secondly, there's a ban on the use of ground troops. I don't know why any commander-in-chief would ever broadcast to our enemies what we wouldn't do. This president seems more determined to tell us what he's not going to do rather than what he is going to do. I'm not advocating a rush to ground troops, but I'm saying, why in the world would you say what we're not going to do? Instead, why wouldn't you go to the Pentagon, go to your military advisor, say, give me a plan to win? And then we're going to win. If we're going to put our men and women in harm's way, and he just announced he's sending hundreds more into Iraq, give them the strategy and the tools they need to win. You've heard the president now say for a second time that he didn't have a strategy. Told us he didn't have a strategy to train the Iraq military. Earlier told us he didn't have a strategy to beat ISIS. I always love it when someone from the White House has to go out there and basically say, the president didn't mean to say what he actually said. That's not a verbal gaffe. He's actually admitting the truth.
I love your enthusiasm for it, but we're out of time for answering our part of our discussion. Are you ready to answer some questions from the audience?
Absolutely.
First question that I've got is coming from Judith from Waterloo, and that is, if Obama signs a deal with Iran and you are elected president, what will you do with it?
I've said clearly, and I signed on, I was proud to sign on the Tom Cotton letter, I would not, if I were commander-in-chief, if I'm the next commander-in-chief, and if this president insists on signing a bad deal with Iran, I wouldn't feel obligated by that deal, and this is why. This president's trying to have it both ways. He's trying to say, well, it's not a treaty, and therefore I don't need the two-thirds, I don't need the normal ratification process, but I still want it to be binding. Well, you can't have it both ways. If it really isn't a treaty, if he really does believe he's got the power to do this, you know, this is a president, we say he's a constitutional scholar. I don't know if anybody's actually even checked whether he's read the Constitution. I mean, he says he's a constitutional scholar. If I were him, I would ask for his money from Harvard Law School back. I'm not sure what he learned in 3 years there. Didn't read the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. Didn't read the 2nd Amendment to the Constitution. Doesn't like the religious liberty part in the 1st Amendment to the Constitution. So I'm not sure what parts of the Constitution he likes and doesn't like. But when it comes to this bad deal with Iran, look, a nuclear-armed Iran is a potential existential threat to Israel, our European allies, and the American people. So he can't have it both ways. If it's not a binding treaty, it's not binding. And any commander-in-chief, one of their most sacred obligations is to protect America, to protect our people, to protect the homeland, a nuclear-armed Iran. And let's not kid ourselves in thinking it ends with Iran. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Egypt are not going to sit idly by. I believe the Saudis may have the ability to go buy this technology from the Pakistanis, and so you really could have a nuclear arms race in the Middle East if this president insists on signing a bad deal. So if I were the next commander-in-chief, if he insists on signing a bad deal, I wouldn't consider it binding. And by the way, just real quickly, a good deal, they should give up their enrichment capacity. They should give up their enriched uranium. Anytime, anywhere inspections, including military sites. By the way, they should have to recognize Israel, cut off any links to and sponsorship of terrorism. They should release all their American prisoners. And then and only then will we begin to consider lifting sanctions. You don't lift the sanctions ahead of time. You lift those sanctions only gradually after we've ensured they've complied with those. And by the way, the other condition, they have to cut off any path to a plutonium weapon as well. Then and only then can we begin to discuss lifting sanctions. Unfortunately, the president seems to have it backwards. He wants to lift sanctions first, and it doesn't appear like he's going to get anytime, anywhere inspections. You've got the Iranians out there saying they're not giving that up, and they're cheating on their current obligations, by the way, while they're trying to negotiate a new deal.
Now, as you know, what the administration would say, Governor, is, hey, it's not a perfect deal that we're working on, but we got them to the bargaining table, and frankly, even a bad deal is better than no deal because we've run out of options. What would you have us do? Put boots on the ground? What options are there then if you aren't going to work out a nuclear deal here? And if Iran sort of says, no, we're going to keep our enriched capacity, we reserve the right to enrich uranium as our sovereign national status, and we're not going to talk to you about the missiles that we're building that might possibly carry some nuclear weapon in the past. If they're going to dig in and be intransigent, what's the next turn?
Well, three things. One, you hit it exactly on the head in the question. We have to have a commander-in-chief who recognizes that a bad deal is actually worse than no deal. Now, think about something. The second fundamental mistake he made was, remember, he threatened a bipartisan congressional majority. There was bipartisan support in Congress to put tougher sanctions on Iran. This president threatened a veto. Now, what negotiator goes to the Congress and says, don't give me a stronger hand? I want to go negotiate, but don't give me more leverage versus the other party. I mean, Mr. Mudd's here, you know, in the business world, nobody in the business world would ever do that. Of course you want the strongest hand you could possibly have, and instead he signaled weakness. And third and finally, the Iranian economy has been hit hard by the drop in oil prices. Our sanctions are finally beginning to have an effect, and tighter sanctions like Congress wanted to authorize, especially when it comes to the banking sector, especially when it comes to the energy and some of these other sectors, we are actually at a point where we have a lot of influence and leverage because of the drop in the price of oil. One of the worst things this president did was, again, start taking options off the table. Nobody's advocating a proactive military strike, but once you start telling the Iranian regime that we're not going to do that, once you start telling the Iranian regime we're not going to escalate sanctions, it actually, here's the irony. When you tell people what you're not going to do, if you project weakness, it actually increases the chance you're going to have to one day engage militarily. It actually increases the cost of American blood and treasure at a future date, because weakness just provokes our adversaries and our enemies. So I think we have many options. We have many options. This president, for whatever reason, has chosen to ignore it. Now, remember, this isn't new. In his first term, in his very first inaugural address, he talked about his approach to foreign policy. He had then had the Green Revolution. He refused to acknowledge or in any real way truly support those in Iran that were looking for regime change. You then see how he treated Assad, a friend of this regime. You then saw how he was, I think, softer than he could have been on Putin. And some have speculated maybe he did that because he needed Putin's help to do a deal with Iran. This isn't a new development. This administration seems to, I don't know whether it's because of his legacy or because just his naivete or his misunderstanding of American interest in foreign policy, he seems determined to get a bad deal done. I think we've got the first president, at least in my lifetime, if not ever, who does not believe in American exceptionalism. That's a very dangerous thing to have a commander-in-chief. I don't think he believes in American exceptionalism the way you and I do and were taught by our own parents and the way that we're trying to teach our kids.
You touched on Vladimir Putin. I've got a question here from John, also from Waterloo. What would you do to assist the Ukraine state against Russian aggression?
A couple of things. One, there's right now our government's not, that they've got a request in. They'd like to purchase more military equipment. We should be doing that, not just non-lethal aid. I mean, I think it's great we're sending them MREs. It doesn't really help when you've got Russian-made tanks coming into the eastern part of your country. So I think we should be willing to...
Don't forget about the walkie-talkies.
Yeah, that's right. So we need to be able to provide them lethal assistance, defense assistance as well. Secondly, look, Putin is a rational, I believe, he's acting what he thinks to be his own rational interest. He is in Crimea, he's in eastern Ukraine, because he doesn't think he's going to pay a price for it. Now, I think the best way to deter him, not only for more aggression in Ukraine, but other countries in eastern Europe as well, wouldn't it be great if NATO had a couple of tank brigades or a couple of that we could go park over there? Now, here's the problem. As we've hollowed out our military, it's become harder and harder for us to credibly go mobilize resources. It's not clear we actually have the equipment and the troops, even if we wanted to do that. The best way to stop Putin is to have a credible deterrence. That could be tighter sanctions. It could be advanced placement of NATO troops and equipment, as well as better training with our allies. Some of these are allies bound to us by treaty, by the way. These aren't just allies on in theory. And so I think the best way to stop and contain and reverse what Putin has done is through credible deterrence. I think the reason he is there, make no mistake about it, if Reagan were in the White House today, Putin would not be in the Ukraine. He looks over to the White House. He doesn't fear the consequences. From his side, this has been a successful incursion. He hasn't paid a real price for it from his perspective.
Got another question. This is from someone in the audience. They didn't put their name down. But this year, the U.S. government was not prepared for the spread of Ebola. What could or should we be doing to prepare for the next outbreak? Or I'm going to broaden that out to the next bio-warfare threat. Mm. And the person who wrote this also noted that ISIS has made that threat, and it's a credible one.
Absolutely. Well, first, we can stop sending anthrax all over the world. We can stop by spreading these agents ourselves. But secondly, you may remember during the height of the Ebola crisis, I think out of political correctness, the president didn't order some just common sense travel restrictions or some stronger precautions from some of the more heavily impacted countries. I think to me that just made common sense, and I wished he had done that. But in terms of the bigger question of how do we prepare and how do we protect ourselves, in my paper on defense and foreign policy, I note that there are only a couple of countries that have the cyber skills to actually pose an existential threat to America. Russia, China, there are a handful of countries. There are not many. But there are countries, there are individual actors, and there are rogue groups that can use asymmetrical warfare to do serious damage to our economy, our quality of life. And that could be cyber, but biological agents as well. And unfortunately, with the advance of technology, it is less and less necessary to have the support of a nation state to engage in asymmetrical attacks, including biological attacks, on America. There are a couple of things. One, I'd mentioned earlier, as our federal government has gotten involved in too many things, we've begun to neglect some of our core responsibilities. And you saw that in the vulnerability of the federal data. Now, imagine, there was a commentator today who made this point. This was data on federal employees. If they're not safeguarding the data on federal employees, how confident can we be that what are they doing with the rest of our data? I mean, this was the data that they were supposed to be trying to keep protected and taking extra precautions to protect. So first, we've got to limit the number of things government's involved in and refocus our priorities into actual defense of our country. And that means we've got to take more seriously. This won't be the first or the last cyber attack on our homeland. We've got to harden our infrastructure, and we've got to make it harder for others to do damage to our country. And that's going to take investments, and that's going to take resources and education. And now's the time to do that, not after the next attack, not after it is too late. So again, instead of the federal government trying to tell us what size sodas we can drink, instead of the federal government trying to tell us you've got to buy this type of insurance, instead of the federal government telling us you can't have these religious beliefs if you want to have a business, even if you're not hurting anybody, instead of the federal government trying to run our lives and having the EPA regulate every bit of water in every state, and instead of having the EPA trying to strangle our economy, let's reorient the federal government what it should be doing. Part of that is homeland, true homeland security, protecting our country. Now's the time to harden our infrastructure and our communities. And when I say infrastructure, and I'm not just talking about our national infrastructure like computer. I'm talking about our grid. I'm talking about our water. I'm talking about our food. I'm talking about our infrastructure in our country.
Here's a question that many people actually sent in, both from the audience and also before. And that's this. You talk about raising the defense budget, increasing the budget in order to rebuild our force structure and our force strength. It's a great idea, and many people even recognize the necessity of it. But isn't your proposal really going to be a budget buster? Don't we already find ourselves swimming in debt? How are you going to make the numbers come out if you're going to be talking about defense spending increases of the kind that you talk about here and that you just presented to us?
Absolutely. A couple of things. First, let's remember how we got here. You had the president's own defense secretary go through a thorough review, then Secretary Gates, and present what he felt like was a responsible budget for the military. This wasn't a Republican proposal. This was the president's own cabinet secretary. And then, seemingly out of thin air, the president rejects that budget request, and OMB and the administration comes up with a new number without the justification after this thorough process. It wasn't that they tied it to a different explicit change in policy. It was just they came up with this number seemingly out of thin air. Bipartisan experts agreed that this number wasn't realistic, wasn't enough for our military to be able to do what we've tasked them, the obligations we've tasked our military planners with. In terms of how do we make sure that we have enough resources to invest in our military, look, we need to shrink the size of government, not just slow its growth rate. So in the state of Louisiana, since I've been governor, we've reduced our budget 26%. We've got over 30,000 fewer state government employees, state government jobs, since the day I took office. As a result, our private sector economy, our folks in the private sector have done better. We're a top 10 state for job creation, more people working than ever before, more people living than ever before in Louisiana, earning a higher income than ever before. We've got 90,000 jobs, $60 billion of private capital investment coming in our state, reversed 25 years of out-migration, 7 years in a row of in-migration. We need that kind of fiscal conservative change in D.C. Too often, the Republicans as well as the Democrats tell you, well, you can't balance a budget. You can't repeal Obamacare. You can't shrink the size of the federal workforce, shrink the size of the federal budget. That's nonsense. Forget the military investments. We're done as a country if we can't do those things. Over $18 trillion of debt. Nobody in D.C. is talking about how do you balance the budget, pay our bills. They're a bunch of math deniers. That's really what they're, if we're honest about it, they're math deniers. They know this isn't sustainable. They know this doesn't make sense. They keep kicking the can down the road. We've got to invest in the military, even as we shrink the size of our government. The way I look at it, you figure out what you needed to spend to protect your country, and then whatever's left, that's how you figure what you've got to run the rest of your government. The Constitution is very clear about this. There's only one thing it tells the federal government it has to do, and that's to protect us. And by the way, this is based on historical spending patterns. I'm not saying, look, I say 4% is a goal. The reality is it needs to be driven by the real needs of our country. But if you look at what we've spent historically, we're nearing an historical low post-World War II. At the same time, China is investing in a blue water navy. We're going to have fewer and older ships. At the same time, the other countries are investing in more advanced technology, and as you mentioned, missiles from Iran and North Korea, and other countries are investing in their air forces. We're going to have fewer troops, older, and fewer planes. We're making equipment, we're making our forces use equipment that wasn't designed to be in service this long. Some of our oldest planes will have been in service for decades. So this isn't an option. The reality is we're going to have to do this. The sooner we do it, the better for our country. The longer we delay it, the more expensive it's going to be, not just in dollars, but in American blood. Here's the moral obligation. The commander-in-chief has to deploy men and women in uniform around the world to protect us. Freedom's not free. It's a volunteer military, the finest military in the world. It is. It's the finest military in the history of the world. Any commander-in-chief owes them the best training, the best resources. If you're going to potentially be sending somebody's husband, wife, son, daughter in a harm's way, how can you possibly contemplate doing that if they don't have the best training, the best resources, the best equipment? That is a solemn obligation we make to those that defend us. So I don't think it's optional. I don't think this is one of those, and it shouldn't be partisan. Post-World War II, there used to be a bipartisan consensus. We were going to build up America's tools, soft and hard tools, to project our power, to protect our people, to win the Cold War, the eventual Cold War. Especially as we transition from World War II into the Cold War, there was a strong bipartisan consensus. There should be a bipartisan consensus today. I'm a conservative Republican. I would hope there'd be enough Democrats that would recognize the need to do this as well. Hopefully this isn't just a Republican imperative.
And last time I checked, building ships and submarines and shipyards, building planes and aerospace factories, designing software to power the systems that keep those systems going also creates jobs, doesn't it?
It does.
It has an economic rebound that also are part of it and historically been part of it.
Well, it's also created technology spinoffs. We need to have, not just we need to have the most ships and planes, we need to have the most advanced equipment and weaponry. We cannot allow anybody else to get beyond us. And you've got countries that are willing to invest those resources. We do have to beat ISIS. No mistake about it. We have to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear power. But the midterm threat that we need to keep an eye on is the rise of China. Look, you know that something is changing. It's not just allies in Asia. You've got countries like India and Vietnam that have not historically always been America's allies. They've been non-aligned or been in other spheres, now looking to America for leadership, eagerly saying we want to integrate with America's values and economy and militarily and diplomatically. We want to be closer to America. They're not going to wait forever.
It's a huge opportunity, isn't it?
It is.
For the next president.
It is, but if they don't see American leadership, at some point they're going to hedge their bets, and they're going to go elsewhere. They're not going to wait forever. We've got an opportunity right now, and I hope we don't waste it.
Okay, now we come to the big question. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
A lot of people say, Bobby Jindal has been governor of Louisiana, a really good governor. He is somebody who has a lot of experience in Louisiana politics, worked in the federal government with Health and Human Services. But what does he really know about foreign policy? What does he really know about that? Now, I got to tell you, at the end of this session here, I don't know if they can really carry out that sort of accusation anymore. But they do ask the question about, do you have the experience, the kinds of connections, knowing people, powerful and influential people around the globe that would really make for experienced foreign policy leader? That's the question they pose. I want to hear what your answer is.
You know, I think the best president that I can remember, certainly in my lifetime, when it comes to many issues, but certainly foreign policy, was President Reagan. He was a former governor as well, and I know that folks in D.C. that try to make this argument put too much value on D.C. experience. And I guess if you lived or your career were in D.C., maybe you would do that as well. I think what made Governor and then President Reagan so successful in foreign policy was that he came with a clear, articulated vision. And let's not forget, he was laughed at when he said it. President Reagan said when he was campaigning, and before he was campaigning for president, we need to rebuild the military. Post-Vietnam, he saw the hollowing out of the military. He said, secondly, we need to win the Cold War. Containment wasn't enough. He described what he called the evil empire, and articulated not only through the hard tools of military investment, but the soft tools of America's role as an inspiration, that shining city on a hill, where freedom and liberty could be a shining light for people who were oppressed all over the world behind the then Iron Curtain. Let's not forget he was ridiculed when he said that. If you listen to the so-called smart folks, especially the folks on the left, and I suspect if you read a lot of editorial pages at the time, this is what you would have heard. He's going to bankrupt the country. We can't afford to invest in the military. You would have heard he's going to wake up the sleeping bear. We can't win a conflict with the Soviet Union. They're so much more, they're better positioned than we are. This is a foolish, he's going to turn the Cold War into the Hot War. All of those things were conventional wisdom of the day. Obviously, as Prime Minister Thatcher observed, Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without firing a shot. I think what we need in our next commander-in-chief is a clearly articulated vision for America, our role in the world, what our foreign policy needs to look like. For me, it comes down to peace through strength. For me, it comes down to American exceptionalism. We don't need 4 more years of apologizing for America, criticizing America. Don't need 4 more years of thinking that if America retreats, that void will be filled by people with good intentions towards America. We need to understand that weakness is a provocation. Strength is the one and only way America has ever experienced peace. And that is the way, that is the only path forward for us. And I'll close with this observation. It may be tempting to some to think, well, we can just hide behind these oceans. That's not true. I don't know if it was ever true before. It's certainly not true in today's world. Weakness only delays and makes more expensive that eventual confrontation. Our enemies are still out there, and to your point, they're not just out there, they're coming here. So the choice is not whether we confront our enemies or not, it's whether we confront them on our terms or not. Peace through strength works. Preparing for war is the best way to avoid it. The one common language that every one of our enemies and friends will understand is a stronger America. And also should add, it's not just investing in our military. We didn't talk about this as much today, and there will be another time and another place for that. We've got to rebuild our economy. A stronger America at home leads to a stronger America abroad. 2% growth, I know we had negative growth this first quarter. 2% growth is not a real recovery. EPA running the economy is not a success for a strong economy. The highest taxes in the developed world is not a success, a formula for success. Obamacare, with bureaucrats between you and your doctor, all these regulations, all these disincentives for people to create jobs, that's not the recipe for a stronger America. So we also need a strong economy to have a stronger foreign policy as well.
And boy, a thriving American economy, if there's anything that would help to restore respect for the United States around the world, that would be it. But that's going to have to be for another time. Governor, thank you so much. That was really marvelous.
Thank you very much. And thank you to our audience as well. Thank you all very much. Thank you.